Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. It's no surprise that study after study have found that a large majority of Americans believe the government isn't working, see it dominated by special interests and partisan gridlock. But can your average American do any better? Well, my guest today has done some sophisticated polling where citizen participants are given policy statements, causes and effects that are vetted by both conservatives and liberals alike, and have found that on many issues, Americans can find a consensus solution. So how do we get Congress to the same place? That's the idea of citizen cabinets, a project of Voice of the People, who aim to eventually create these policymaking simulation groups in all 50 states and 435 congressional districts. The state of Oklahoma and the 4th district within it is one of three pilot projects. Stephen Cole is my guest. He's the president of Voice of the People and a senior research scholar at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland and director of their Program for Public Consultation. He's worked for over two decades with policymakers in Congress and the executive branch. Citizen cabinets members are scientifically selected to accurately reflect the people in each district. They'll be briefed on an issue with unbiased background information vetted by experts and congressional staff from both parties in advance. They weigh the arguments, learning about the policy options that are actually on the table and evaluating pro and con arguments on each option. And then they make tough choices, choosing from a menu of policy options. The second part is that the recommendations of citizen cabinets go back to each member of Congress. And hopefully that will help break gridlock. Stephen Cole is my guest today. Stephen Cole, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Your work on the citizen cabinet initiatives follows a very simple thesis. The idea that despite what polling tells us about us being a 50-50 nation or a 40-40 nation with 20% in the middle that flips and flops, that we're not as ideologically divided as our policymakers. What is the evidence for that? Because when we look at recent elections, it does seem like we are a 50-50 nation. And based on what our policymakers are doing, we don't seem to be able to come to consensus on very many issues.
Well, whenever you pose a question to people in terms of party affiliation, you do get a polarized response. And there are some ideological slogans that you can present to people that do create something of a polarized response. But there is quite a lot of data showing that if you ask people what government really ought to do, when it gets really specific about what policy should be, you find a lot of convergence. In fact, we did a study just recently where we took 388 poll questions on a wide variety of topics from a wide variety of sources, and we looked at how often people who live in red districts or predominantly Republican districts went in the opposite direction from people in blue districts, and 92% of the time they went the same direction. So it's really a myth that the polarization that we see in Congress is driven by the people they represent when it comes to concrete questions about what government's supposed to do.
How much consensus is there on a given issue?
Well, it varies from topic to topic.
I would think there are some topics where there's more
polarization. Yeah. But even in areas on the hot-button topics, like abortion or gay marriage and things like that, while you find some polarization on some questions, on others you find a surprising amount of agreement. What is really key, though, that we found is that we are working to go beyond questions that just ask, favor, oppose, and give people the tools to have a more subtle response, you might say. For example, around something like the budget, the federal budget, looking at standard polls, you ask, well, do you want to cut the deficit? And a majority says, yes. And, do you want to raise taxes?
No.
The majority goes, well, no, not really. Do you want to cut spending in education? Well, no. And Social Security? Oh, me grandma? Defense? Oh, gosh, aren't there a lot of threats out there? And so you have all these little separate responses. And if you look at those, Republicans and Democrats tend to be a bit different on each of those. But the work we do are what are called policymaking simulations. And we try to put the person in the shoes of a policymaker. So in the case of the budget, what we do is we present them the budget, and this is done online. So they say, okay, here's the budget, how it's presently divided, 31 line items. Here's the deficit. Oh, and also down here are the sources of revenue. And you can adjust each spending line in the budget, And as you do, you get a little input about, you know, this little bubble that follows you and tells you how you're doing and how what effect it's having on the deficit. Because you can increase or decrease.
Does it also have an effect of what it's doing for that policy area? Say, because, you know, as you well know, when people say, well, we need to cut the deficit. Well, we need to cut foreign aid. Mm-hmm. Well, you could cut every single dollar foreign aid and we still have a deficit.
That's right. Well, this goes back to one of the core ideas of this kind of work. Actually, we did a study back in 1995. One of our first, we call it our hit single because it got so much attention. There was a lot of talk about cutting foreign aid a lot at the time, and there were polls that showed a majority of people thought we were spending too much on foreign aid. So we asked, well, what percentage of the budget do you think goes to foreign aid? And the median estimate was 20% of the budget. We said, well, how much do you think it should be? And the median response was, oh, well, let's cut it down to 10%. And then we said, well, how would you feel if it was 1%? Which is what it was. And hardly anybody thought that was too much, right? So it's not people's fault. They hear, you know, all kinds of information is thrown at them. Like, you know, a leader will say, I'm going to balance the budget. I'm going to cut foreign aid. And which gives the impression that it's something very large, but in fact, it's just 1%. Well, and
we here in public broadcasting have dealt with that because there are polls where it shows people think that public broadcasting gets 10% of the budget. And we're like 0.001 or something like that.
So the idea in a policymaking simulation is to give people the correct information and then let them work with it and make the modifications within that context. Because it's not really a reliable method for guiding government when people are acting and giving responses that are based on misinformation. The founders were very emphatic that the sense of the people, the values and the priorities of the people should govern, the reasoning the people should govern, but not the misinformation. If they're misinformed, that shouldn't govern. So the idea in this process, in the policymaking simulation, is you give them the correct information, and in that context, in fact, in terms of humanitarian assistance, even in the context where they were dealing with a deficit, humanitarian assistance was increased. So they do act consistent with that. They also have the opportunity to increase or decrease revenues. And on balance, people do pretty well. We did this a few years ago, and the average person cut the deficit over $400 billion for 1 year, far more than Congress has ever been able to do. And there were some differences between Republicans and Democrats, but there were a lot of similarities. They were more similar than they were different. Republicans increased revenues, Democrats cut spending, you know, so people acted out of character. And also what was very interesting is that people didn't always act in terms of their interest. People with incomes over $100,000 increased taxes on themselves just as much as people who would not be affected by it thought it should be increased. So people really do go into a mode of thinking where they're going, okay, what's needed for the common good? There's a problem here, it needs to be solved. And they try to solve it.
When you do break something down like the federal budget, it really comes down to about three or four or five big areas. One is military spending. Another is social entitlement funds, Medicare, and Social Security. And we think of these as really intractable problems that a politician doesn't dare cut any of them, because if you look soft on defense, that opens you up to an electoral threat. If you talk about cutting Social Security or raising the taxes associated with Social Security or Medicare, the same thing.
Right.
What did you find when you started doing this? Are citizens really willing to get in and make tough choices about, say, like means testing or increasing the amount of money subject to Social Security tax or things like that?
Right. Well, that's another great example. As you say, Social Security is seen as the third rail. And in a, you know, political environment where one side is trying to get an advantage over the other, it's really easy to take any movement toward change and jump on them and say, oh, you're doing X or Y, and being alarmist about it. Now, we did this, one of these policymaking simulations on Social Security, and we presented all of the we explained the problem of the Social Security shortfall that basically it's going to start running out of money and we won't be able to make the payments, the benefit payments. So first of all, that was explained in some detail. And then we said, okay, here are a series of options for dealing with the problem. And then we gave an argument pro and con for each argument. Now, all of these, this briefing and the arguments pro and con for each option were vetted with congressional staffers who are the key experts in Congress on Social Security from both the Senate and the House, from the Republican and the Democratic Party. Everybody weighed in until everybody was satisfied. So they evaluated each option in terms and evaluated these arguments. Then in the end, all of the options were put together. For each one, you were told, okay, if you do this, it will reduce the shortfall by 10% or 5%. And, okay, now, what do you want to do? What do you think should happen? And most people did solve the problem. And, in fact, what's really interesting is that three-quarters of Republicans and Democrats agreed on the steps that eliminated most of the Social Security shortfall, and a majority agreed on steps that had completely eliminated it.
Wow.
And they did things that were, you know, not what you would always expect. For example, Republicans increased the amount of income subject to the payroll tax. There was even a slight majority who favored eliminating it entirely.
Eliminating the limit.
The cap on the amount of income subject to the payroll tax. Democrats, out of character, majorities favored raising the retirement age and also making some modification in the benefits by decreasing the amounts that go to people in at higher incomes. So, you know, the Republicans and Democrats weren't exactly the same, but there was fundamentally they found a tremendous amount of common ground.
And in a perfect world, you could take these results to Congress. It would be a starting point for finding a serious compromise to solve an issue like that.
It's not that the idea is that you take this in, okay, now you follow that in a mechanical way. But the problem is that virtually everybody in Congress has made commitments to certain organized interest groups that say, don't do this, never do that, you know. And they're very afraid of, you know, that they're going to lose the funding. So they each go in a very rigid form, you know, so I can't change, I can't negotiate, right? And then nothing happens, right? Well, if the public comes in and you have people, you know, particularly if you have people who are in the district or state of the member, it's going to make it easier for them. It's going to give them a political cover to stand up to those interests. And we've had now over 65 meetings with congressional offices, and they very much agree that, well, if this thing was in place, if this was being done, then we would be able to show more flexibility. Now, I should really clarify and jump forward here. Everything we've been talking about, all the results that I've been talking about so far are with a national sample. We have a new plan, which is to create what's called a citizen cabinet. This would be done in each district, in each state, because, you know, you give a national sample to a member of Congress, they go, well, yeah, that's interesting, but those aren't my people. So we really concluded that you have to have a citizen cabinet, a few hundred people in each congressional district, in each state, so they can hear from their people. And that's our new project that we're just getting started now. And Oklahoma is going to be one of the first test cases where we're going to be building out a citizen cabinet in the state of Oklahoma, and also in Tom Cole's district specifically. We're going to build that one out as well. So there'll be about 500 people for the state overall and 400 for the Oklahoma 4 who will go through these processes and will give the senators and Tom Cole the input about their views on the issues that Congress is dealing with.
Now, is the goal to create these citizen cabinets in all 435 districts?
That's the goal.
Uh-huh.
And we've been promoting this idea in Congress, and we've gotten a very positive response. The idea is to create a National Academy for Public Consultation that will create a citizen cabinet throughout the country. It would be over 130,000 people. But the first step is to demonstrate it and show how it would work. And that's what we're about to do. And we picked three states, and Oklahoma will be one of them.
Now, are you looking at a revolving panel so you're not, you know, a person doesn't constantly weigh in over and over again? I assume you're using statistical methods to get a balance of and a true composition of the views of the district.
That's right. We use the same scientific sampling process used for survey research in general. And the goal and the outcome is you produce something that's a kind of mirror of the state or district demographically and in all the key ways.
Is that getting more difficult to do, you know, because polling is just everywhere now, and you know, anytime there's a political race, you're getting polled constantly. And I know for myself, as well as many other people, as soon as you hear what it is, you put down the phone, you ignore the message. Is it more difficult to get that statistical sample?
We're about to find out. If any of your listeners get a letter in your mailbox from the Citizen Cabinet inviting you to be part of this, we hope you respond favorably, because it's very important for us to hear from the people. We have polled on the subject, and people say that they think it's a great idea and that if asked, they would do it. But they also have to get their attention. And so, yes, that's a challenge. We think it can be done, but yes, it's a challenge, and if you're listening out there, we need your help.
My guest today is Stephen Call. He is the director of the Program for Public Consultation at the University of Maryland and the president of Voice of the People. Voice of the People is announced a new initiative for the citizen cabinets, eventually all around the country in various states and in various congressional districts. But Oklahoma is one of the first states, and I guess it's the fourth district in southern Oklahoma will be the main congressional district. But I assume you'll be giving information from Oklahomans across the state for the Senate delegation.
That's right.
Let's get to the tough part. You get this up and running, and you get you find that the ideological divide is not as big on a statewide level as you have nationally. You go to a Congress member who's in a safe district. The only thing he has to fear is upsetting his corporate backers and special interests who will back a primary candidate, whether it's Republican or Democrat. How important is this information going to be to them? And how important in their mind will it be potentially bucking the special interests and risking a primary challenge? Mm-hmm. What have you heard from members of Congress?
Well, the key thing is that what we have found, and as I say, we've had over 65 meetings with the congressional offices, with high-level staffers, in some cases with members, and they are interested. They want to know. They want this input. They are not happy with the way things are working. They feel they don't like how much special interests are breathing down their neck.
I can imagine if you were a member of Congress, you go there to get things done.
Absolutely.
To help people.
You don't go there to work for special interests, that's for sure, right? And they're frustrated that things aren't getting done. They don't always like, you know, being bossed around by the party leadership, you know, where everybody has to toe the same line. And a lot of them actually want to be more flexible, but the party leadership is saying, oh, no, you got to stay in line. And because of the special interests that support the party, and we can't capitulate. Any movement away from the party line is capitulation to the other side. And so you have all this inflexibility. And many of the offices don't like this. And for them, if their constituents, if they have data that says, okay, my constituents want me to show more flexibility in this way and that way, that will give them political cover. They can stand up to the special interest better. They can say, look, I can't really do that. You know, I look at my constituents are saying this, or they can say that to the party leadership. So it gives them more room to maneuver, and they really like that idea.
Well, what about, you know, without electoral reform or non-gerrymandered seats, a minority can influence, you know, the election, because in a closed primary system, it can be a minority even of that political party that sways the balance. Can this system overcome that? Because, you know, a special interest can motivate people to go after an incumbent.
When in many districts and states, people don't really know what other people think, right? And it's also really surprising a lot of members of Congress and staffers don't know what's going on in their district. We have done studies on this, asking, you know, staffers to predict what people would say on poll questions in their district, and it's amazing how bad they are at predicting what those responses will be. If that information is really clear and it's, you know, what the consensus is in the district, and I don't mean like 51-52%, I mean a really clear consensus, and that's reported on in the local paper, you know, local television, and people in schools are going through these processes and discovering this as well, it's going to create a certain a sense of, you know, what the people are saying that will have some strength. And if there's a departure from that by a subgroup, I think that will help mobilize people to get out and express that, because they know that something's happening that is at odds with the voice of the people. But if you don't know and you just think you're in the minority, when in fact maybe you're not, Then you tend to stay home. But if you see things are happening that are actually at odds with the majority and that other people are with you, there are a lot of reasons to believe that this could change the dynamics. And it would also make it, when the member speaks back to it, to a subgroup that's opposing a position that he or she is taking that is consistent with the majority, then it's understood in a different context.
And it also gives the public a little more accountability if there's
that's
a clear consensus and,
that's right.
and the candidate doesn't
right.
go with that clear consensus.
Right.
That provides a little more accountability
right.
on the candidate.
And then, it doesn't mean that the member is always going to do exactly what the majority says in the citizen cabinet context. But if not, then there's a need to explain it and there's a need to engage and to kind of enter into some kind of dialogue. It requires more accountability in that sense.
Well, how much time does it take to participate in one of these citizen cabinets if we were contacted by
sure.
your organization?
Every 3 or 4 weeks, you'll get a email that says, this policymaking simulation is ready to go. Now, by the way, if you're invited and you do not have internet access, we'll find a way to get internet access to you. So it's not limited to people who already have it. And then you go through one of these processes, and people say they find them really interesting. It's this interactive process that goes online, and so you learn about the issue and so on. And then ultimately you weigh in. And the process takes 20 to 30 minutes, varies each time, and then that information is aggregated, and your member of Congress, your senators, they hear about what your views are, and you'll get to hear what other people have to say as well.
What are some of the issues you've done? We talked a little bit about Social Security reform, and
mm-hmm.
I think that over this summer you've done one on the nuclear negotiations
that's
with
right.
Iran.
Mm-hmm.
What did you find there?
Well,
because that's a very nuanced,
right. yes,
difficult
it is.
Question.
Right.
I think
right.
even very smart people
right.
who
right.
know the right thing
right.
to do don't know necessarily right. know the right thing to do.
Yeah, there's a question about in dealing with Iran, should we negotiate a deal with them where they can have some limited enrichment? Right now, we are saying, we in the UN are saying, we don't want Iran to enrich at all, and uranium at all. Now, they say, well, we need to enrich to the 5% level for nuclear energy purposes, but we won't to the 90% level for nuclear weapons. And the position of the U.S. has been no, we don't want any enrichment because that makes it easier for you to break out, so there's a push in Congress to ramp up the sanctions further to try to get them to not enrich at all. So that's a big debate about which way to go because it's unlikely that Iran would agree to that at least right now. So. But there's a kind of deal that is being discussed, and we took people through all the ins and outs of the deal, the deals that are being proposed, and presented the arguments pro and con for each one. And the main focus was which way should we go? Should we make a deal? And the nature of the deal that's being proposed is limited enrichment with more intrusive inspections so that we can really know what's going on and so that we'll be able to detect it if they go beyond that and start going to into a level where that would give them the capacity to build nuclear weapons. Or should we ramp up the sanctions? Now, there's a complication in ramping up the sanctions, which is, well, we've already cut off all our economic relations. So ramping up the sanctions means actually leaning on other countries to stop their economic relations with Iran. And a lot of those countries don't like that, and that's one of the problems with it and so on. So when we presented these arguments, something that was very interesting is that both the arguments for and against both options were found convincing. That's a good point, which is that is – and we think that's actually a good sign.
Really?
That people are really thinking, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that's, they're really deliberating, But in the end, they went 61% in favor of negotiating a deal where Iran had some limited enrichment capacity and more intrusive inspections. 35% went for ramping up the sanctions in an effort to get them to completely stop enrichment.
So a military strike is really not on the table.
Nobody's
right now.
Really discussing. That's not seriously being considered. I mean, people talk about it at times, but
it is in the rhetoric, though.
Yeah, but you know, you go to the Hill. I mean, nobody on the floor of Congress is making that argument that we should actually. It's very clear. The military will say, okay, you can take it out for a while. They'll just build it underground, and that might set them back for 2 years or something like that. But it won't really solve the problem. The only way you can stop it with military force is to invade the country, and we're not going to invade. Iran is a very big country.
Yes, it is.
So it's really not in play at the moment. So we're trying to get, again, put people in the shoes of the policymakers. Now, one thing I want to emphasize, too, we will give this to the citizen cabinet, these policymaking simulations, but we will also put them online so that anybody can go and do them. And you can come in and see exactly what the people went through, but you can do it yourself. And then at the end, you can formulate your conclusion, and then we give you the opportunity to then forward that to your representative and your senators. Really, and it's just right there at the end. You can just fill in your write a little letter and push the button, and off it goes. And that's just as important as the citizen cabinet part, because members really want to know, hear from people who are opting in, who are self-selecting, who are being actively engaged. They don't just want to know what the general distribution is, which would be reflected in the citizen cabinet. They want to hear from people who are actively stepping forward. So it'll be a real opportunity for everybody and anybody to get better informed and to give input that's more targeted at the choice points that Congress is really dealing with. So it will really be much more effective. So we're going to be promoting the idea of people doing this in schools and civic groups, people getting together and having discussion groups and so on. It's not just about the citizen cabinet, but the citizen cabinet is really key.
Now, have you had any results from a statewide pool as opposed to the national yet, or are you just getting that ramped up now?
We're just getting that ramped up now.
Now, I can see why you would choose a state like Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. It's considered a very red state. Mm-hmm. Do you think there'll be much divergence from the national result?
Frankly, I don't think it'll be dramatically different. That's the research we've done so far suggests that Republicans and Democrats are not so far apart not as far apart as they are in the Capitol.
Mm. Now, what are the other states you've chosen? Have you chosen a strongly blue state and perhaps a toss up state?
Right. The very blue state is Maryland, and the purple state is Virginia.
Yeah, well, that sounds really interesting. Mm-hmm. When do you expect to have results from the first wave of?
Maybe two or three months.
Yeah,
we'll be starting the recruitment process in the next few weeks.
What's been the reaction from people here in Oklahoma and the other two states?
Well, first, in terms of the delegations, Senator Coburn and Senator Inhofe's office have been very receptive and very interested. Tom Cole's office has been very engaged in the process.
I'm sure they
very
are, interested, since you're right? going to be pulling his district.
Well, but I mean, we're only going into places where people say we're interested. That sounds something that would be good. We're trying to work with them. We're trying to help them understand. And again, there's been a very positive response.
What's the name of the website for people who want to do one of these simulations?
Yeah, if you go on VOP.org, that's for Voice of the People, VOP.org, you can not only see some of the results, you can go through these simulations yourself. For example, the one on Social Security or the one on the Iran negotiations, and there are some others. So you can really have the experience yourself, and you can also use them as a means to formulate your opinions and send them to your member of Congress or senator.
All right. Well, Stephen Cole, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Stephen Cole is the president of Voice of the People, a senior research scholar at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, and director of their Program for Public Consultation. To learn more about Voice of the People, visit their website at vop.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.